This is episode number 63 with Marissa Brassfield. Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Kwong, and each week I'll bring you an inspiring guest with an empowering message to help you rise higher and live your best life. Each guest shares their time of struggle and setback and what specific mindsets, tools, practices, or habits they use to overcome so that you can apply them to your life. This show is to remind you that you're not alone and that there's always a pathway up. Thanks for spending some time with me today. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you. Our struggles are a call for us to rise. So here we go. Let's dive deep now so we can rise higher together. What is up, my friends? Welcome to another episode of the Rise Higher podcast. Now, if you've ever struggled with grief and moving forward in a productive way, or you've had a hard time managing your emotions and creativity as efficiently and lovingly as possible, then this episode with Marissa Brassfield is for you. And before we hop in today with my guest, I wanted to make sure that y'all knew about my Self-Love Transformation online course. So if you're a regular listener of the show, you know that I am deeply passionate about self-love, and I am committed that everyone I come into contact with has access to the wisdom and practices that will connect them to knowing how to be self-loving. Now, this isn't just about self-care or buying yourself flowers. To me, self-love is deeper than that, and it's truly how you relate to yourself. Now, in the past couple months, and I've spoken to so many people who've shared what a difficult time that they've been having. And quite honestly, I've gone through it myself. Some real talk here. The past few weeks have been pretty rough, where I let my mind get the best of me. And I was relating to myself from a place of doubt, judgment, and criticism. And I realized how harsh I was being with myself and what supported me into shifting back into a place of peace and power was diving back into the self-love teachings and my self-love practices, the same exact ones that are all in my online course. So I had to open my heart to myself again with compassion, acceptance, and forgiveness to release that crap that was getting me down so that I could let the light back in. And like I shared lately, I've been in a lot of conversations with people who share that they're in the same space, that they're struggling with self-judgment, self-doubt, and even shame. And the way that I was able to support them to bring that light back in was to give some beautiful nuggets of self-love that they could embody to start to shift their energy back to a place of love. Now, something I know is that when we're really harsh on ourselves, or struggling with doubt or self-judgments, that really kills our feelings of happiness and inner peace. And no matter what we try to do outside, it's not going to shift anything. It's really about relating to yourself in a loving way. And with every single person that I've ever worked in with coaching or through hypnosis, one of the first things I prescribe to them is self-love, because it's the healing salve that allows you to feel happiness, peace, and abundance, and all those other good high-vibing feelings again. So if you've been on the struggle bus and know that self-love is the way to bring back that feeling good again for you, make sure you check out my Self-Love Transformation online course, which is at 40dayselflove.com. And I'll also be sure to mention it again at the end of the show. Okay, so on to today's episode with the incredibly gifted and ridiculously efficient Marissa Brassfield. Marissa is an integrator, storyteller, and secret weapon for visionary entrepreneurs. She's been described by her clients as a goddess of operations and a force of nature. And Marissa helps successful entrepreneurs around the world materialize their crazy ideas into high-performance teams, efficient business models, and transformative customer experiences. And Marissa honed her skills working under the mentorship of Peter Diamandis, serving 7 years as operations goddess at PhD Ventures, which you're going to hear all about today. Now, she created Diamandis' annual Abundance 360 Executive Mastermind in 2013, and she leads the experience and content design for its annual January summit. In her consulting tenure with Diamandis, Marissa also orchestrated hundreds of millions of dollars in business, including best-selling launches for Bold and How to Make a Spaceship, a digital course in partnership with Success, and recruiting the Strike Force. Now, I'm sure you see why Marissa is a secret weapon for visionary entrepreneurs and why her clients call her a force of nature, because she sure is. And today, Marissa is joining me to do an incredibly personal deep dive into her personal grief process that she went through when both of her parents passed away within 14 months of each other. And she had to move through this challenging time as she was in the midst of building an incredible career. You know, when we lose the people that we love, it can feel as if our entire world stops. And yet there are ways to support ourselves to continue moving forward. And Marissa shares today how she processed her grief, how she connected with her true authentic self, and the overall pivotal moments that shaped her life. And Marissa and I talk about everything from flipping into gratitude as much as possible, to how she vowed to never repress any emotions, to how she found solace in creativity, work, and refueling her motivations. Now, I believe you are at your best when you really take care of yourself. And Marissa couldn't agree more. And through a series of events, you'll hear how Marissa took care of herself to rise up and how she and her husband started recreating and re-architecting their lives, and how Marissa integrated her most challenging time into her growth, which we all have the opportunity to do. And because Marissa is the goddess of operations and being ridiculously efficient, of course, we've got her giving some incredible tips on productivity and how to tap into your own superpower so that you can become ridiculously efficient too. Now, I'm really excited for you to connect today with Marissa and to feel her beautiful heart. So please let me know what you think of this episode and share this out with your peeps. Go ahead and take a screenshot of the podcast that you're listening to right now. Share it out on your socials, so on Facebook or on Instagram, because sharing is caring. And if you share it out on Instagram, make sure to tag me at I am Stephanie Kwong so I know that you're tuning in, because I always love connecting with you guys. So hit me up on the socials. All right, my loves, let's drop in with Marissa. Welcome, Marissa, to the Rise Higher podcast. It's so wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Stephanie. I am so excited.
Me too. I think this is, how many times did we reschedule? Seven, six?
The perfect amount of time.
I know. I was like, we were so ready, you guys. This past Monday, was it? Or last Monday? And then it was like Mercury retrograde. I like to blame all electronic malfunctions on Mercury retrograde when it's actually happening. And I was like, no way. I have to tell Marissa that we can't do it. So I'm so happy that electronics are working. I get to see your beautiful shining face. And thank you for being here today.
It's my treat. And I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity to just to talk through some of the pivotal experiences that have shifted my life and my adulthood, and really tell some of the backstory, because, you know, what's on social media and all that is often just the most sanitized, like wonderful version after I've already taken the experience and distilled it into wisdom. But it's, I love what you're doing in forcing people to tell the tough parts and all the real moments, the make or break moments. And it's so powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And you, I mean, Marissa, well, first I want to actually say this one piece before we jump into your story, because I think it's so cool that you're a productivity expert, you're a specialist in small team communication and organizational efficiency. And this is actually what lights me up the most. I love that your official title with Peter Diamandis at PhD Ventures is Operations Goddess.
Yep. And he actually coined that.
He did?
As a nickname. And of course, it stuck. And I'll tell you, there is, I've gotten the coolest responses from people. Everyone from Ariana Huffington to Tim Ferriss, like all these heroes are just like, hello, goddess. And I'm like, I'll take it.
Yes. Yes. I'll take it. That's so great.
I really love that. I just had to say that because I was, when I first read it, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. That is the best title ever. So hello, goddess. You have such a tremendous story of rising up from losing, you know, your parents all while growing your career. And when you shared your story on the phone with me when we were first getting acquainted, like I knew I wanted to share your story with my listeners because I know how incredibly hard that was to lose your parents. I can't imagine yet because I haven't actually gone through that, but I'm very close, you know, with my family. So it's unfathomable. And you so beautifully moved through that. And I know that you said you didn't want your parents' death to beat you down, but instead you rose up. And not only did you end up rebuilding your home, but you and your husband rebuilt your lives. So I'd love for you to take us to the start of this big transition for you. I know when we spoke, it was around 2012, right? When you were freelancing, you had your company for a year and your husband was being deployed in the Army and you were building your life in San Diego. But I'll let you take it from here and share.
Yeah. And thanks so much for the intro. This will be like the first time that I've really told the story all the way through. So I'm really grateful for the opportunity. So yeah, we're in 2012. It's January 2012. My husband deploys to Afghanistan with the U.S. Army. And here I am in our apartment in San Diego with our, you know, our three cats and our little life. And I'm juggling some freelance clients and one of the other wives and I were like, hey, you know, we start trying to keep ourselves busy. So we ended up signing up for 12 obstacle races, end up doing 14, some Tough Mudders, some Spartan Wow. races going. And then about midway through the year, we're training, we're doing these events. And I go, gosh, I could really like, I should be using this time more effectively in terms of revenue generation. Let me see if I can pick up another client. And as luck and the universe would have it, I see this online job ad for busy entrepreneur seeks online community manager. And everything in this insanely detailed job ad was something I'd done in either with a client or in the past. And I'm just like going through it and I'm like, I can do that. I can do that. I've done that. I think I can talk my way through that. I think I can figure it out as I go along, you know, and you sell yourself into it. And then by the end of it, I'm like, okay, I've got it. I've got to apply for this. So, I go through this gnarly 2-month recruitment process. I learn the night before my interview that the busy entrepreneur in this ad is Peter Diamandis. And I had seen that in Googling him that earlier that year he'd published a book, Abundance. So I go, gosh, I better read this man's book before I meet him. So I download the ebook. I read it in the evening. And then I go in for the interview and I start working with him. And he said in that interview, he was like, we are going to do amazing things together. We are going to build businesses. We're going to launch products and more books. And I'm going to build a team around you. And it's beautiful because he did every single thing in that interview that he said he was going to do. So this is 2012. Later in that year, he goes, have you ever run an event before? And I said, no, but I can figure it out. And that event would become Abundance 360, which we co-founded, and it's his Entrepreneur's Mastermind. And so I started getting involved in how entrepreneurs think, but specifically how they learn about technology and start using it and experimenting with technology within their businesses. So super exciting, just on an absolute rocket ship in every sense of the word. And as things are heating up, we had our first event for Abundance 360 in January 2013. And it's with Peter Diamandis and Ray Kurzweil on stage at Singularity University for 2 days. And the team was me and Peter's executive assistant, Connie. So after the event, I have all of the recordings. And by this time, Mike, my husband, was back from his deployment and just getting settled and getting back organized with real life. And gosh, Ray had a cold during the 2 days. So here I am. I've got all these, the audio and video, and I'm meant to edit the video which I was Googling and figuring out how to use Final Cut Pro. And then, and Ray had a cold. So this whole 2-day experience, he's sniffling and coughing. So I tell Mike, okay, get a headset, get the other computer, and start watching a module ahead of me so that by the time I get there, I'll know exactly mark the spots where I've got to turn down the audio and cut that piece out because he was coughing and his mic was hot. So this was like early on in the days where it was just total hustle, make it work. And wow. I always think of Tim Gunn and his make it work moments. So that was the excitement of my January and February. And then at the end of February, my mom called and something was very clearly wrong in her voice. She was such a sunny, positive person, but she told me that she had cancer. And I still remember her voice saying it. And she was so upset at that diagnosis and having to tell me, but she was so... it kind of steeled her up, and she did all this research about what to do, how to prepare for it. And it was gnarly. So April, she goes in for her cancer surgery. And before her cancer surgery, she pulled me aside. She had this pink folder of all these things, what to do when a loved one dies. And it was like literal checklists of every single thing that would have to happen. It was every account number, every insurance account and login, all the social security numbers, for her and my dad, and like the addresses for things, and just all of this detail and research. And my dad refused to look at it, which is why she was sitting down and doing it with me. He was like, no, you're going to be fine, Betty. This is ridiculous. So she sat and went through the whole thing with me. And so she goes in for surgery. It was a successful oral cancer surgery. So she's healing up for 7 days in the hospital. And at some point in the night, a blood clot got stuck in her tracheotomy and basically starved her brain of oxygen for about 10 minutes. And so
wow.
She was in a coma, effectively brain dead. And we were advised at the 72-hour mark that the brain function was not, consistent with a full recovery, or even that, she would wake up. And we were in total, complete denial. She and my dad had been married for 44 years, and he was just like this heartbroken, absolutely heartbroken. But we didn't, it was just the three of us. I'm an only child. So like that was our little family unit. And so we kind of procrastinated on the decision to remove life support and, kind of waited it out for a month while we just researched every single thing we could find. We had a lawyer take a look at the medical records to see what was going on and if there was anything, any kind of malpractice, or I don't know. You try and search for certainty, and you try and search for something, a reason that something happens. And sometimes, things don't happen for a reason. So, at some point along there, the insurance ran out and they didn't want to have my mom in the hospital. So we elected to bring her home for hospice care. So for the last 24 days or so of her life, she was at home, and we had amazing hospice nurses come in and out. And it was such a horrible experience because here was, my mom at home, but we knew she was going to die. And we removed life support and her feeding tube and stuff. And, I'm getting emotional. And it was just this crazy waiting game where the brain function had ceased, and the person that you knew is just not there, but they're not quite dead yet. And so there's this intense waiting game and almost limbo that you're in. So her birthday was January 23rd. January 24th, she passed away. And so that was wild. My dad did not know what to do. He was heartbroken. And then later that year, we had to put my childhood dog down. So it was like insult to injury for my poor dad. And then at the same time all of this is going on, we had a book launch. We had a product launch for Peter, and we had to push it back when she was in the coma, because obviously I was not there. And then when she actually died, you know, we had all these affiliates lined up who were going to mail for us. And, you know, it's so, anyone who's done product launches, it is so hard to get some of these big name affiliates and to get on their calendars. And, you know, you work things out months in advance. And we already had to push the launch back 6 weeks because of the coma situation. And so we were at a place where when she passed away, I had two interns who had just started with me. And we basically had to have them do all of the customer service for this launch while I was taking care of affairs with my mom and my dad. So what that meant was I had two interns, and then overnight, of course, product launches. We had an international, Vishen Lakhiani from Mind Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Mailed to his largely international audience just from all over the world. And they basically woke up to 1,700 emails for customer support. And so here they are, just brand new in their roles. And I'm like, I got to go, you guys. Here's an epic template. Like, here's who to call and how to escalate things. But I've got to go, and I might be back in a week, or it might be 3 weeks. And it ended up being about 10 days. So that's a little color to the story. So in the post, in that like post death period with just me and my dad, it was really strange. I watched my dad going through the stages of grief, denial, and like just he didn't know how to be alone. And so he, for the first time, like they were married 44 years, but he had a girlfriend for 8 months, and like he had her, you know, living with him. And that was so strange, but I now understand that was a part of his grief. And then December 1st, 2014, so about 14 months after my mom died, or I don't know, a little more than 15 months, he died of a heart attack at the house. So here, both of my parents passed away inside my childhood house, which they bought in the 70s. And then I was born in the 80s.
That heart attack I hear so often from men who, it's like heartbreak.
Yeah,
it right? is. When the love, you, it seems that a lot of times if the man passes first, the woman can live on. But if they were deeply intertwined, it's like the men can't.
Yeah.
Survive that long. They really die of heartbreak for their partner.
I fundamentally believe that he gave up, that he just didn't want to do it anymore. And so at the time of his death, this is December 1st, we had already, Mike and I had already made plans to go to Costa Rica for a friend's destination wedding, which would be held over like the Christmas, New Year's break. And here we are, and I'm kind of splitting time between Los Angeles and San Diego, just getting affairs in order. And that checklist that my mom gave me was helpful because it's so sad, but I had two check marks, you know, down all those columns.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Just doing it again. But at least that process was there. And it was, I hate to say it, but it was easier the second time. And so we were like, gosh, do we go on this trip? Do we cancel the trip? And I'm so glad that we said, you know what, let's just get out, let's get away, let's push pause, figure this out. And we had an amazing 10 days in Costa Rica. Our friend's wedding was beautiful. And, you know, one of the things we were deliberating is what we're going to do with this childhood house. Because, you know, it was like, as we saw it, there were three options. You know, you sell it entirely. And for what we would have gotten for the house in 2014. Maybe we could buy a condo in San Diego. I don't know. And then there was the, you know, rent it out to strangers who would inevitably like rip apart.
Not take care of the house.
Yeah. And just dated design, and it needed a renovation, and it's an old kitchen, and, you know, it's just old things. It's a house that had been lived in. And you know, it would just take so much to make it, really rentable in a modern environment. And then there was the third option, which was, do we move in, make it ours, and just renovate it and do, I don't know, update, make the updates ourselves. And so it was over, we were in a group, in a pool all day long, day drinking, and literally 96 beers into it among friends. We were like,
how many friends?
Oh God. It's fair to say, I can't remember.
Yeah. If you said like five friends, 96 beers, or 96 friends, 96 beers,
oh, no,
is
no,
very
no,
different.
No, this was like a 14-hour extravaganza. So Mike and I look at each other and we're like, you know what? We've got to do it. We've got to move in. We've got to make it ours. So we come back from Costa Rica with that renewed sense of spirit. And in January 2015, now an important data point here is Abundance 360, the big annual event, the mastermind, happens at the end of January every year. And so part of my responsibility is all the content design, the experience, how the 3 days unfold, I do the opening script for the video. There's so much creativity that goes into this event and careful thinking about every moment. And then of course, helping Peter prepare his content and his remarks and getting him into the state. So I'm in this crazy soup of emotions, and we ended up moving all of our stuff January 2015 because I was like, okay, I can't afford to pay for a mortgage at the house and our rent. You know, you don't budget for people dying. So it's like, and what the financial implications of that are. So we had movers bring a bunch of our stuff, and they all sort of landed. So there's this photo of me where I'm standing on the seat of our couch, and I've used the moving boxes, which were just piled in this tiny 1,300 square foot 1931 house, all the boxes are piled up in things, and I've fashioned a makeshift standing desk where I'm standing on the couch cushions, and the laptop is on top of these boxes, and it's just ridiculous. And I turned to Mike and I'm like, I can't create here. Like, I literally cannot create in this environment because there's all the stuff from my parents' 44 years of marriage. There's my baby things. There's all my college, you know, mementos and things that they kept around, plus our stuff from our marriage and our life together. And it was just literal clutter everywhere you look.
Yep.
So one of the first things we discovered is that, I always knew that we had this great big backyard, but we discovered that there are sheds. There are lovely sheds that anyone can install, and accessory dwellings don't need permits. And so we had a buddy who had a construction background, and he and Mike got together and we bought this shed off Costco, and it arrived on a pallet with a big old stack of things. Wow. And they spent about 3 weeks putting it together, insulating it, putting electricity in, like all the like legitimate stuff, painting a whiteboard wall. And now all of a sudden, this backyard shed office, which we called a shed quarters, or an office bar, because during the week it was an office and on the weekends it was a bar. It just became this ultimate creative sanctuary. And so I would open up the doors and here I am in this backyard that I've grown up playing in. And I'm looking at what I call my giving tree. And it's as a child, it's an elm, and I used to clip the boughs and make like a little fort. It was a backstop when I was a softball pitcher. And then here it just as the wind goes through, it just makes the most delightful sound. And then the birds are singing. I felt like Snow White every day because you hear the birds chirping, and people would always notice on conference calls. And I'm like, wow, it sounds so tropical where you are. And so it was just a magical place. And I started doing so much of my best work. And so some of this is, I grew up in a house with a lot of love. We didn't have money, but we had a lot of love. And so there was this element of me where I knew that this, I didn't want this to ruin me. That wasn't what they wanted. They gave everything for me. I wanted it to be, you speak with people, everybody knows somebody who has buried the grief that they never got to experience when their parent died or parents died or someone influential and close to them. They buried it, they kept it down. And then 40 years, 30 years later, it comes out in these horrible ways. And I was like, no, I don't want that to be me because my parents would not have wanted that. And I don't want that. And, I knew that I could assign the meaning that these events and experiences had on my life. And I was just hell bent on making it, better. And then actually I read a book called Super Better by Jane McGonigal. She's a video game designer and just a real thinker in this realm. And she wrote a book that was basically about gamifying self-improvement. And she introduced a term to me. It was new to me. So we've heard of post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic stress disorder. But post-traumatic growth was the term that I learned through her. And it's the idea that you can go through something and an exceptionally stressful, viscerally stressful situation and come out of it better, stronger, faster than ever before. And I was like, oh my God, that's going to be me. As soon as I read that book, I was like, that's going to be me. This is going to be the catalyst that creates my best life. It has to be. And I developed that mindset where it was just like every single thing I do and touch and you know, consume must somehow make me better or help me process this experience or my feelings or whatever more effectively. And it honestly just has been compounding exponentially ever since in terms of fulfillment, personal creativity, resilience. And it's just, you know, some people induce post-traumatic growth from running marathons. And it's that process of going through the grueling training and the experience, that physical challenge. That's one way you can fake it, or you can have like a, not fake it, but replicate it without some traumatic death experience. Fake is not the right word for a marathoner. Control Z.
Control Z. I love you. I love how your brain works. So this is... Thank you for sharing all that. And it's so, again, incredible how everything was all happening and then just one after the other. But then there was so much to unpack in what you shared. And to see you standing so strong now is really beautiful to witness. I want to take it back to when your mom first passed.
Yeah.
What did you do to support yourself in that time? And then also, with your dad, because I know a lot of times when people in a family unit, they lose somebody, there are people in the family who feel like, I need to step up and be the strong one and take care of, you know, your father, your sibling, or whoever's suffering more, but you're all suffering equally, right? How did you support yourself? And then how did you get to be there for your father as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was a trial by, I mean, you're going day by day and there's no right, there's no wrong. To be honest, like I would sometimes hang out with my dad and we would just drink wine or beer all day and all night long and cry together. And that's what we needed. And then sometimes we would, watch movies and do stuff, but everything reminded my dad of my mom. I reminded my dad of my mom. So there was so much, even in our hanging out, that was difficult because we physically have a very strong resemblance and how we speak is very similar sometimes. So that was challenging, but honestly, I let myself feel things completely. I'm openly crying as we record this because that's part of it. It's like, I vowed to not repress things that I would, you know, if something came up, it was just, hey guys, I just need a few minutes. And then I would just go for it. But I would, you know, then go back and, you know, do the thing. But, I also used work and creativity and poured a lot of that emotional energy into creating a productive something, whether it was an event or an experience. And I poured a lot of passion and soul into that. I did a lot of writing, a lot of cathartic writing. Some of my best writing is about this period of time. And it's just in processing these really complex feelings. Writing's always been in my DNA. So that was a big way. And sometimes I'd be crying so hard that my nose is, you know, stuck and sniffling and I can't see the computer screen through the tears. But like, I still look at that writing now and I'm like, wow, that was powerful. What a badass.
Yeah. I want to find your articles. I know I was going to save this question for later, or I'll just make the comment now. The fact that you've written 15,000 plus articles, I'm like, what? How does one even do that? But I can see, you know, obviously you said writing's in your DNA and what a powerful form of self-expression and releasing, and that you did it. And I really actually love to hear that you felt your emotions, because I see you as someone who is just such a powerhouse and you get things done. And I think a lot of people who are in that way, they'll just distract with work, right? They'll get lost in that, and that's where they'll channel it to really avoid the feeling. So it's really great to hear that you actually allowed yourself to feel and left your two interns in a lurch. You're like, 1,700 emails, bye. I got to take care of me right now. Have fun with that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
and that's
good that you
took
care of yourself.
Is, you know, when business is going really well and exploding in a good way, it's so tempting to just compartmentalize. And for a lot of people, compartmentalization is survival. So I don't want to discount that. But for me, it was very much, I didn't want, and you've got to do it sometimes. So if it's a Monday or you've got a deadline or whatever, you do. But I didn't want to get to a place where there were too many consecutive days of that, because I knew that I just felt this time, this period of time was a make it or break it moment. And I knew that I wanted to make it a positive impact and something that, you know, I discovered a lot of power through pain and through the experience of turning that pain into almost fuel for whatever you're doing, fuel for your resilience. And, you know, it's like sometimes you wake up and you don't want to get out of bed and you don't want to do it, but it's like, I woke up today. I have
That's
to
a win. Yeah.
I have to, and I will.
Yeah. Yeah, that's powerful. What was most helpful from Mike to support you?
Oh gosh, just being there. Like there were days where I would just heaving like sob, and there's something about like being with your person and that like gigantic hug, like my dad, hugs from my dad are, you know, he was this big dude and that, you know, you can't replace that stuff, but, hugs from your person like that, and just sobbing, like openly sobbing and ruining shirts and getting them wet and all that stuff. Like that, just letting it happen and not judging or not wanting me to calm down or, you know, and just letting it happen when it happened. That was huge.
Yeah. What a strong man to be able to just let you be. And not need to fix it.
Right.
Sometimes they're like, oh, what do we need to do to fix it? And it's like, just let a woman be. Mm-hmm. Be in the storm and just hold her in the storm. That's really all that needs to be done. Yeah. I know that you shared as well. I mean, obviously this experience really was a catalyst for you to recreate and re-architect your lives. What are other ways that you saw that happened for you through this time?
Yeah, so I discovered how important it is for me to be me and stop being who I thought I was supposed to be. My dad was a very sort of, how do I say this elegantly? He was a perfectionist and demanded the very best out of me. And it was like perfection it was like, oh, you got a 97. Why wasn't it 100? And so there was this very much, not enough bit of me that was fueled during that time, during high school and all that. I was an athlete. And, so there was a lot of like performance related, that was how I got validation and love. But there was almost this freedom after they passed where I was like, okay, I've got to start living for me now. And what does that uniquely mean? How do I feel validated? How do I feel emotionally supported and secure and powerful and successful? And that sent me down this entire path of personal growth and development and really listening to a lot of powerful women admit vulnerability and like, what that looks and sounds like. And I'm still learning, but that was a big element of it. And then uniquely defining how we live. Anyone who works and lives remotely, like you're already in a situation where you talk to your friends at cocktail parties and no one knows what you're doing and no one knows what it's like to live this life. And, oh, well, do you just work in your pajamas? And it's like, well, no, actually I wear gym clothes, but... But like how to uniquely strive in an environment completely of your own design is itself really liberating because you get to set up the rules and parameters and like the boundary conditions for your own success. And so I started really diving into what makes me uniquely operate at my best And then what I need in my off time to keep that going and to like refuel my motivation and excitement. And I really started getting into hikes. One of the things about online work is it is totally blissful to just go off the grid and go dark, as we call it, and be completely untouchable. Like, I'm on the side of a mountain. Sorry, couldn't get to you.
Oops, no reception.
I couldn't help it. But those little moments of sanity that came. So we would do Sunday fun day hikes where we would hike in the morning. We still do this. Hike in the morning and then come back to the backyard and grill, just relax. Those little moments are just where I see so many leaps. Like, we're not technically doing anything productive. And as someone who focuses on productivity, the trap is to feel like you've got to make every moment about work or doing something for work or, you know, creating a deliverable.
Being productive even, in some way. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the biggest challenge is like, okay, start with one day. Started with a half day. The half day on the mountain, that is for you. That is the work. And then it was Sunday fun day, like relaxing and enjoying a Sunday, because I know so many knowledge workers where Sunday afternoon and evening is not Sunday afternoon and evening. It's when we start panicking about Monday.
Yes.
So it's almost reclaiming Sunday as that day of rest. And then and then it was like, after I had that, then I was like, okay, well, how about Saturday? What if Saturday is the fun day instead of the chore day?
Well, look at that.
And then it just started going and snowballing from there. And I really started redefining my experience of time and how I'm using that to either do my best work or live my best life. And increasingly, I'm finding that the fewer hours I spend actually working, I'm doing better work. I'm making better choices about what I'm working on. I'm saying no more frequently. I'm delegating more aggressively. And when I look at the unique contributions I'm making, they are of higher quality. There's better critical thinking. There's better creativity. It's more authentic. It's more genuine. And it is better.
Yeah. And you know, I've broken it down for the most part, but a ex-workaholic, same thing. I got came home with all A's and it was with one A minus, and it was why did you get the A minus? Right. So this striving for perfection and constantly needing to do very well to feel good enough was conditioned into me as well. And I also had a childhood trauma, so to speak, an interpretation when I was younger that if I didn't perform, I would be abandoned. And so there was this constant need to be doing something and go, go, go. So it was very uncomfortable to unlearn that behavior and do exactly what you just shared, is to create spaciousness and to build in more fun. And I was somebody who was always like, work hard, play hard. Mm-hmm. I'll sleep when I'm dead. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it was a really broken strategy because I wasn't doing all my best work. Creativity was definitely stifled. And I ultimately didn't feel good. And that, I mean, if we don't feel good, what's the point? But I like relearning all those pieces and knowing that you're enough, you're okay. If you're not constantly working, you can slow down and in time speed up if you need to. But ultimately what you shared, you're at your best when you take care of yourself and create the time to really be free and enjoy yourself on this planet while you're here. So
that respect of time and respecting how precious and scarce it is has been one of the biggest takeaways from this experience. And then on the other end of the coin, through my work with Peter and Abundance, I've gotten to study all these emerging technologies and how they're going to change our future. And so I'm looking at artificial intelligence and robotics and stuff like that. And like the work hard, play hard. But I'm also like, well, if robots take our jobs and artificial intelligence can do a lot of the basic tasks and research and all of that, I've got to get really good at the higher order tasks that are going to take longer to get automated and digitized. And so I've got to really level up my creativity, my ability to, you know, connect the dots and integrate different pieces and different elements. Because that's, you know, as we get into this future 5 to 10 years out, those are the skills that are going to be most needed. So there's also like the strategic element where it's like, okay, if I'm not going to be a really great robot, and because I get tired and I have to go to the bathroom and eat and things like that, and you know, we have bad days and some days I can't get out of bed and do stuff. Knowing that I'm going to be an imperfect robot, I might as well try and be a really great human.
Oh, hallelujah. And you are a great human.
So are you.
Thanks. What are some of the biggest pieces of growth that you experienced? I know that one of them that you mentioned was through this, that you can live for yourself and not for your parents' approval anymore and just to be you. As you deep dove into that, what are other growth experiences or insights that you had for yourself or new levels of awareness that were sparked from this time?
Oh, yeah. So many. So comfort in discomfort and being comfortable with uncertainty, because there is, I realized I can't control anything. And some of the things, I mean, if I thought about the family conversations we would have, everyone thought that my mom would live longer than my dad. They thought it. Like, it was just wired into, you know, their assumptions, because my grandmother had, you know, she lived till 99. So they just assumed my mom would also be like that. But yeah, you take those like freak accidents into account. I mean, you don't. So it's the comfort and discomfort, and extending from that, like trusting myself and my abilities and my, my ability to adapt to whatever's going on and figure out what has to happen, to make it out there all right. Like, whether that's a skill I've brought to project work, to personal finance, to home renovation drama, is just like everything, we'll figure everything out as it goes along, and not always having to have a plan. Because one of the first things about my plans, I love making plans, I love making lists and stuff, but you know, something always, you know, there's a wrench thrown.
Doesn't go as planned.
Yeah, exactly. So being comfortable with that and expecting it has actually made me better in business, but also in life. And then there's this quiet confidence. Anyone who's gone through and seen the other side, you know, they've gone through something crazy and come out the other side better and stronger. There is this different element and quality of resilience. It's the, I've got this, like I can do this. And people have noticed that visible shift in they've called it power and leadership and, you know, all these amazing, beautiful words, but like, it is simply just who I am now. And so there is this element of my game that has been leveled up just because I've made it out the other side of this. And I've been so committed to growth and constant growth that, there is this, I'm not afraid to grow. I'm not afraid to not know the answer. I'm not afraid to cry on the camera, and do a video interview with zero makeup on. And
you look amazing.
Thank you. Yeah. But there's those elements that, like, you know, 6 years ago, no chance, absolutely no chance.
How does someone tap into that now? Because look, I know that there's, you know, three ways to really start to change. One, of course, if you just choose to. Two, many times it's when someone is going through something difficult and it does become the catalyst. You can either choose to rise or you just fade away. And most people, of my experience that I've been around, have risen up from it. And this is why I love sharing their stories. But I don't always feel like there has to be this dramatic or a huge life event that occurs for people to start owning their power, taking on these things that you've shared. What are ways that you would encourage people, you know, to really rise up? And even if they don't have something like you did to kind of push them, but it requires their own inner pushing right now if they're feeling stuck in some way.
Ooh, yeah. Number one thing, I try and flip into gratitude as quickly as I can. If my husband and I get into an argument, I write down 10 reasons I'm so grateful for him. I'm grateful for our relationship. I'm grateful for that argument. I'm grateful for what that catalyzed. I'm, you know, and sometimes I'm so angry, I'm like, I'm grateful at breathing. I'm grateful. You know? I have to really dig deep, but like, you just keep going and keep going and keep going. And then at some point, like, there are sometimes you're so, you know, I'm so mad that I can't like think of something to be grateful for. And then that's how I know, like, okay, I've got to keep going. But at some point, there's this point where I've listed enough things to be grateful for. And I'm like, and then I can zoom out and go, okay, like this situation, this thing is just one smaller bit of a much larger landscape, much larger. It's a puzzle I haven't figured out yet. It's an experience I'm in the middle of, like whatever that analogy is for the situation, it's so much bigger than the small reality I'm seeing right then. And so I make gratitude lists a lot. And, you know, sometimes it's just in my head, or I'll wake up and I, you know, usually like when I wake up or before I go to sleep, if not both, I'll come up with three things I'm grateful for like from that day. And that's a really, really big one, because so often the everyday things are what plague us the most, the projects, the, you know, the work drama and colleagues and stuff. So sometimes it's like, if it's the other, like the thing that I'm most irritated about, I try and find a way to be grateful for that. And if it isn't for that situation, it's what I'm going to get as a result of having had that experience.
Yeah, which is usually the growth on the other side. That's so good. That so falls in along the lines of something I do as well. Gratitude, it's like flipping the perspective, right? I'm going to look at this experience from a whole different lens. And something that I do is, I know that when I get triggered, I'm looking through the confines of a very narrow lens that is only seeing things usually from my programming of the past. That's what's triggering it, because really everything's a neutral event. And then if I feel stuck there, or I'm like in a certain emotion that I'm like, that's really not working for me or the other person, and not really who I want to be energetically as a being on this planet, I'll start to find new interpretations of like what it else could be actually happening in this scenario. Right? Exactly what you said. But it's like, what's another story I could tell myself about what's going on? What's a different interpretation that I could create so that I can decrease whatever is like building up in the wrong way and really allow me to open up to new possibilities? So.
Oh, that's a great framework. Though, as you were sharing that, I'm like, oh, so sometimes I'll ask myself, like, what's actually true about that thing? Like, what's actually true?
Yes.
And then it's like, oh, what's actually true is I got assigned this work project and I'm tired right now.
Yes.
I need to eat.
Yes. And maybe take a nap. Yeah. But yes. Yeah. Oh, see? So good. Because I think so often we listen to the thoughts in our mind, we feel the feelings, and we think that they're real. And really, it's just something that needs to be addressed internally. And when we're willing to look inside and go, what, like you said, what's really happening right now, that can already help us to manage ourselves mentally and emotionally with the things that life throws at us. So, yeah, I know, you know, I've worked with different people through grief, through the work that I do. And I know that people sometimes go, oh, well, I'm just trying to like basically let it go, be done with it, right? Or have some sort of closure with the grief. And that's not always the most helpful way to look at it. Many times I see it as like, how do we actually integrate the experience into who we are and what will that look like moving forward so that I don't have to just close it out. Have you found that that's what you've done, or have you found closure with it? What's been your experience?
Oh man, I am still in conversations with my parents. I write them letters on Mother's Day and Father's Day, and I read them to their ashes and I cry, and you know, and I go to bed and I, you know, wake up feeling refreshed. And, you know, anytime I'm going through something tough, it's hard, especially as an only child, when that is your support system, to just have it. So for me, it's definitely an everyday thing. Some days are harder than others. Some weeks will go by and I'm totally fine. And then all of a sudden it'll hit me and I'm like, I miss my mom. And I just like, I get all teary. And, you know, there, it's just that ebb and flow. So I try and take it day by day. And the approach I've taken is not to try and squash it when it comes, knowing that sometimes it'll come when I'm driving or in the middle of an interview or in just these random inopportune times during the day where you just like, I'll just really miss one of them, or it's a conversation that you know, or a win that I wish I could have shared. And those are the moments where, boy, it's like, I know they're not with me. I know they're not in this dimension. I still have like big questions about spirituality because I've had some crazy dreams that I can't explain. But the larger theme of it is like, I know, you know, the physics of what's happened and, you know, just the biological state of my parents and they're not here. But at the same time, I will still like say hello in the backyard and tell them about my day, just like I would have before. And, you know, it's just it's a strange relationship with it, but it's my relationship with it. And so it's like how I've taken, you know, the approach I've taken to everything else, which is just sort of make up my own rules and see what fits and what works and feels right. And if it feels right, keep doing it and try my best not to get caught up in what other people think about it.
Isn't that the game of life? Not caring what others think and really just doing you and honoring yourself and what works best for you. Thank you for sharing that. That's really beautiful. I know we were supposed to record on the anniversary of your mother's passing on June the 24th. And then, of course, it didn't work out, but I was actually glad. I'm really glad that you got that day to you.
Me too. In hindsight, I was like, oh, it would have been great for branding and great for the story. But like, I got emotional today. So I can just imagine I would have been a mess.
No, I was like, I'm glad she got to take care of herself. So really, really happy for that. So I, just because I have the questions about it, since this is your expertise, and I think my listeners might gain value from it, you are known for being ridiculously efficient, and you really, really are. Again, shocked that you've written over 15,000 articles. How the heck do you even do that, woman?
So, like, so the 15K was like, oh, so, okay. Yeah. It's a few things. One is, yeah, that was it within a, you know, 3, 4, 5 year span. I stopped counting. That's why I say plus. I'm like 15,000 plus. I just stopped counting. Like it just got exhausting. But, you know, powerful incentives. In those early days of freelancing, how much I was able to write directly mapped onto what I could bring home. So I was either paid by the article or by the word, or I had powerful incentives and like a compensation structure that rewarded volume. So I, you know, it's about understanding how you think, and I see things in frameworks. And so I used that as an advantage where I could compartmentalize the work. Okay, I'm going to come up with 50 different ideas. Then I'm going to think of a structure. There's only 3, 4, 5 structures when you think about most articles and long form articles. And, you know, there's only a few structures. So if you list the structures and then you can kind of map that onto it. So I have this whole course that I'm putting together that's all about that. And, you know, it's like, can you put together 30 days of content in 7 days? I say yes. And so it's about that and really distilling your ideas and thinking quickly. But as, you know, zooming out of that, ridiculously efficient to me is about understanding how, because each of us has at least one superpower. So it's about discovering what that superpower is and then optimizing to the best of your ability, your professional or how you earn money around that superpower, because you're naturally going to be efficient and effective at something you're already good at, that people count on you for, and that you, it's easier and faster for you to get better at. So when you have that superpower, it's like investing in your greatness. Like, you know, you dive into all the resources and it's fun to practice something that you're great at, you know? And so people are like, oh yeah, work on your weaknesses. And it's like, okay, then you can be average at your weakness, or you can take your superpower and keep on sharpening that skill so that there is no one on the planet who does it better than you. And that's what ridiculously efficient is about, is like, we all have the same 24 hours, but how you spend that time, how you invest it in yourself and your bigger future. I mean, that's the difference in what people do, is just that leverage on time.
Amen, girl. So if that is so good, because I think, especially for entrepreneurs, you know, you're wearing so many hats and you're trying to be the graphic designer. And then now I'm a marketer and you're like, I just have this one craft that I'm really, really good at. And this is what I want to do, but I have to learn this whole business side of it as well. So that it's good to just sharpen that one piece that you are good at and hopefully just delegate the rest that you're not.
Oh yeah. And right along with that, like teamwork. Yeah. So for folks who are early on in businesses and solopreneurs, I love creating collectives. Like I have these wonderful working relationships where I barter with people who have superhero skills in areas that I don't have them, so that while we're building revenue and generating revenue, we're coaching each other, or we're bartering time for resources that we don't have. And that's a skill that humans can do really, really easily and quickly, is form teamworks and form collectives and work together.
So good. And then any just quick tips that are pretty universal for productivity for people who maybe get easily distracted or lose focus or procrastinate?
Yeah. So a couple things. Understanding your priorities. Like if you wake up and you have, you know, priority, it's like, you know, theoretically it's one thing, but realistically, it's probably three things. Understanding and starting your day with like, no matter what, these three things must happen. These three things must be true by the end of this day. And just three things is super achievable. Sure, you may have 15 things on your list, but like when it comes down to it, just pick three things and just keeping that running list so that things don't fall through the cracks. But keeping it manageable is the first bit of it. And then the second bit of it is understanding your productivity or your procrastination triggers. So one of mine is if I'm doing work, really cognitively intensive work at the wrong time of day. So I am a rock star in the morning, like from 7 to 1 or so in terms of writing, strategic work, anything that requires like complexity or integrating things, I am next level. I will do more work in that morning than I will in an hour in the afternoon. Four times the amount in the afternoon. It's absolutely wild. So understanding like when you uniquely produce at your highest and best quality, like that's pretty powerful intelligence. And then understanding like some people can just power through in these long work chunks and that is not me. So, I mean, understanding just the cadence and rhythm of your work. So for me in the afternoons, you know, this is when I have a lot of conversations or it's when, I'm doing appointments or errands or things around the house. It's a time that I'm intentionally spending away to either recharge, create something that's completely different, having connective conversations. So kind of dividing the work into the different parts of your day according to your creativity and how you map things. So an easy way you can do that is like set your timer to go off every 60 to 90 minutes and just like mark down how you feel in terms of energy, creativity, cognition on a scale of 1 to 10 and like do that for a week. And you'll start to notice patterns like, oh, I'm on fire from 10 to 2. Okay, those are pretty important hours to block. Block them off. That's smart. And try and protect them and, you know, use that data to your advantage. And then sleep is underrated. It is Arianna Huffington's number one productivity tip is sleep.
Yep.
So having that nailed down and having like the biology pieces, like eating and finding a diet that works for you and finding, you know, staying hydrated, all the basics, that's not the fun answer, but that's the real answer.
And those are the foundational pieces that people forget because they put it aside. And yeah, I met this, I was at an event yesterday and the sleep doctor spoke, Michael, and he's going to be on the podcast to talk all about like the sleep stuff because it's so important. But yeah, thank you for that. You're amazing. If someone's going through something difficult, because I think what you went through or just if other people are just going through a hard time, what are kind of the golden nuggets that you would leave them as they're moving through that time so that they can experience as much grace and ease as possible?
Yeah. So definitely decreasing pressure and noise. So this is not the time where you get critical about your diet. This is not the time where you get critical about your body image or the quality of work or the, you know, there was a several week period, actually several months, if I'm honest, where I thought, can I write again? Will I be able to write again? I didn't know if it would come back because it was so that creativity was so far gone out of my realm of possibility. So, you know, releasing that expectation and that you're going to operate just like before, it's like, this is like the new normal, but it's almost like this is the transition to the new normal. And so just giving yourself permission to figure that out and make mistakes and be inelegant, and ugly cry and, and feel all the things. And, you know, there's, there's also tremendous value in support and gaining and listing support. And I think the worst things, I'm an introvert, but even just one of the worst things you can do is suffer alone. And so if you can be with someone, whether it's a friend, whether it's a family member, a spouse, someone who, you know, is willing to go through it. One of the Abundance 360 companies that members have formed outside of it is called Life Guides. And their whole premise is pairing people who are going through a significant life event, first year teachers, single parents, first time single parents, with someone who's already gone through the other side of that experience.
Wow.
And just having that wisdom and bringing them together. And they compensate the guides who participate, but also, you know, to make it affordable for the people who are going through that life event. I just think that's so brilliant.
That's so brilliant.
That tendency to just want to wallow in your suffering alone. And that, I did it. You know, so there's that element where you've got to let yourself do it and feel and go through the experience how you feel like you want to, but just not being alone too much. And then having some kind of creative outlet, whether it's art or journaling or drawing, and just doing something where you're activating that part of your brain, even reading and just getting lost in fiction or nonfiction, whatever you like to read, and just getting to escape a little bit. Anybody who's into VR, I really recommend Tilt Brush because it lets you draw in three dimensions. And so I would create this beautiful tree that was kind of like my giving tree, and you can blow it up and shrink it down. And so I would blow it up and like sit inside this tree, and I literally had a tree all around me. And I felt so safe in those moments. And it was just this beautiful digital space that I could come back to anytime. And you know, technology can be used for good.
Wow. What's that called again?
Tilt Brush.
Tilt Brush. Okay. By the way, The Giving Tree is one of my all-time favorite books.
Oh, I know. Me too. Breaks my heart.
I know. But I love that book so much. It's my favorite. Marissa, thank you so much. You've been awesome. I have just three final questions to close this out, even though I want to keep on going with you, girl. But what's something unique about you that most people don't know?
Well, I played softball for 10 years and I was a pitcher. And I am ambidextrous, so I pitched with both hands.
Wow, that's rad. Nice, girl. They're probably like, oh crap, here she comes, the pitcher Marissa. We don't know what to expect.
People wouldn't even notice. I was like so slick with it because I would have my an outfielder's mitt, which is larger than an infielder's mitt. And when it was my dominant hand is I'm left-handed. So I would kind of slip it on and wear it backwards to pitch right-handed. And because of the way that moving pitches go, it was opposite. So it would really screw people up. I loved it.
So good. When you're in a dark place, what's your go-to to get out?
A bottle of red wine and a bath or a shower, and I will cry. I let myself cry. And I listen to sappy music that makes me cry even more. And I just really feel it. And like, I think the wine kind of loosens things up a little bit and it makes it not so, not so self-reflective, and you know, the tears flow easier, and I just have that cathartic cry. And then I write, I get in front of a screen sometimes, and sometimes I'll write and I'll have cried so much that my eyes are shutting because they're so swollen, and you know, but then you touch type and you clean it up later.
Exactly. I love you. All right. And knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self?
Oh boy. Trust yourself. You are stronger than you think, and your resilience will become a superpower.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are such a beautiful being, a loving soul, a powerhouse, and I appreciate you sharing your heart with us today as you shared your story, and for all the wisdom that you dropped.
Thank you so much. It's been such a privilege. I'm in awe and just so grateful of what you're doing. And it's so important that we're gathering together and having these real conversations together, because so much suffering happens simply because we're not telling the truth about what we're feeling, what's going on, and that it's okay to hurt and it's okay to not have the answer.
Yes. That was perfectly said. I'm just going to leave it right there. Thank you, Marissa.
Thank you.
I just love Marissa, and I'm so thankful for her vulnerability and her authenticity in this interview. You know, one of the things I really want to highlight is when Marissa shared how she discovered how important it is to be herself and to stop being who she thought she was supposed to be. Now, I know that a lot of people are challenged with this, and this is the game of life, to unlearn the things that stop us from being our true, authentic selves. And Marissa shared that her dad was a perfectionist and he demanded the very best out of her, which is what fueled a not enough part of her during high school, which she carried on into her adult life. And that's where she got her validation and love because of her performance. Now, I know that I can relate to that so deeply, and I'm curious if you can too. You know, that feeling of not enough, or that you have to perform in order to get validation or love, is an insatiable drive that always leaves you feeling empty. And this perfectionism, which stems from feeling not enough, is a happiness killer. And this belief of not being enough is simply not true. Yet it's an epidemic, and you know what? It's got to go. And Marissa shared that it was after her parents passed that there was a freedom for her to finally start living for herself, to release that feeling of not being enough, and to discover how she felt validated, emotionally supported, secure, powerful, and successful, which is so important to do a deep personal dive to discover that. Now, if you're wanting to do that deep dive to release the feeling of not being enough and to learn how to validate yourself and how to emotionally support and ultimately love yourself to feel empowered, happy, and free, you really want to make sure you go check out my Self-Love Transformation online course. Now, you can access this course from anywhere in the world. And I spend 40 days taking you by the hand and sharing with you inspiring self-love wisdom and the exact steps, processes, and daily practices to release negative self-talk and beliefs and to replace them with love. Now, again, you can get all the details at 40dayselflove.com. That's the number 40dayselflove.com. All right, so to close this out, if there's anyone you know who could benefit from this episode, pretty please share it with them. And if you got value from this episode, I would be deeply grateful if you just take a quick moment to write a 5-star review on iTunes, because this really supports the show to go up in the rankings so more people can find it, which means that we can support even more people to rise higher together. So if you're down, I'd appreciate a review. And if you've already left one, thank you so, so much. Now, if you want to connect with Marissa and to learn more about her operational efficiency badassery, you can get all of that info in the show notes. And that is over at stephaniekwong.com/EP63. And feel free to check out all my other podcast episodes there too. Okay, my friends, until next time. As always, I'm sending you so much love.